So you're at Purdue, and it's cold. Pardon? And it's cold.
Well, it's the coldest thing, and we train in their big field house. We did all our work in the field house, throwing, batting, and everything else. And it worked out because we knew we had to do it.
Yeah. Now, I assume you didn't have nearly as many spring training games that year. So it was mostly intra-squad play. When you pitched, did you call your own game, or did you let the catcher call it, or did you have managers that liked to call the pitches?
No. We, most of the time, the catcher called the pitches. And all you had to do was shake him off if you wanted to change. But I'd say 98% of the time, I throw what the catcher wanted.
Who were your catchers, and who was your particular favorite?
Well, when I first joined the Indians in 1928, we had Luke Sewell, Joe's brother, and he was a first string catcher. And then we had Glenn Byatt, who was a second string catcher, but he was a left hand hitter, and they used Glenn Byatt sometimes when the right hander was pitching. Glenn being a left-hand hitter, and then about 1932 or 3, Frankie Pitlack joined the club, so we had three catchers for a few years, and I pitched with Luke Sewell and Glenn Myatt quite often, and then Luke Sewell left the Indians for Washington in 33, and I started pitching Frankie Pitlack and Glenn Myatt.
And those were your two main catchers through the 30s then?
Yeah.
What was it like dealing with the front office in those days? What were contract negotiations like?
Well, they never bothered signing a contract until after the World Series was over. And so back in the 30s, tough to get any money out of the ball club because that was the depression years.
Right.
And in 33, all the banks closed in the country, and we couldn't go to a bank to get any money out. So in spring training in 33, we had to borrow money from Mr. Bradley to get through spring training. So by the time the season opened, we owed him money. The 30s were tough because of the depression years. And we just realized it was those kind of years and everything. So everybody took it pretty good.
When you first came up in 28, did you get any kind of a signing bonus for coming up to the majors? Do you remember your first salaries in the late 20s?
They didn't give you those salaries.
Yeah.
Those years. To sign a contract, you were happy to get a contract. They never gave me any bonus to sign a contract. Never. So that was something new that started later on. And my first contract was with the Indians. It was $275 or $375. I made $275 with Oldman.
Whole $100. Wow.
Happy to get it.
Yeah. Things a little different now.
That's more like meal money now.
Yeah, for sure. Now, did you have any unusual habits on the mound that you went through, any particular procedure, or did you have any superstitions that you followed?
No, my wind-up was the same that I used first year in baseball with Omaha. With nobody on base, I'd get my sign from the catcher, and then I'd take a short windup over my head, and then I take the pivot, my stride, and I make the pitch. And I never kick my leg like they do today.
Yeah.
I always had that low slide kind of. I made my pivot where my hip would go into the pitch and my stride would go into the pitch, and that's how I pitched all my career. And in those years, you couldn't lift your leg because they'd steal your shirt right off your back. You know, they get on first base and they'd take it off for second right away if you kicked your leg. So that's the way we were all taught when I first came up. That was that slide kind of slide stride.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't lift your leg too much, so the runner couldn't get that jump on you.
Now, did you have a pretty good pickoff move to first?
Well, I have to say yes. I practiced that a lot. I had to work on it because that was one of the most important things that a young pitcher had to work on. Otherwise, as soon as you walk a man or they got a base hit, they'd run on you. So you had to have a pickoff play to keep going. And I developed a pretty good pickoff play by lifting my foot just a little and making my move to first base. So they didn't have much chance to take a long lead.
How about your move to second? Of course, there's that famous incident in the 48 World Series with Bob Feller and the move that the out that was called safe. Now,
well,
did you have a trick play that you used to set the guys up at second?
Well, we always had a pickoff play at second base, but we didn't have a timing play like the one that Boudreau put in. Boudreau is the one that started to have a good timing play. When Boudreau became manager, he stepped that up. But the play to second base was you more or less kept your eye on the shortstop, your eye, the second baseman, and as soon as they broke the second base, well, that's when you made your pivot. But then when Boudreau took over, I'd look at the catcher and the cover, and the catcher would give a sign, and then you knew the play was on. And then the pitcher would take his position on the mound and put his arms,
or his hands down on his stomach before he threw the ball to the plate. The catcher would give you a sign, and he knew it was on. And as soon as you tuned it ahead, you'd count one, two, and throw. That was our timing. And Boudreau would move on two. So that's how it worked.
And it worked pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, were you married at some point?
I got married in 1932 to Sandy Schmidt, Hazel Schmidt, from Omaha. And I knew her, I had known her since 1929. We went together in high school, but I never did know her in high school. I don't know how we missed each other.
let's see, we were talking about your wife then. And
yeah.
So you met her after, you went to school with her, but you met her afterwards.
I met my wife, Sandy's her nickname, Hazel was her real name. I met her when I came back from Cleveland. In 29, my best friend out in Omaha that I used to pal around with, he always had a date with Sandy's her girlfriend. So it was a blind date, and he talked to his girlfriend and she set it up, so we had a double date.
All right.
And I married her in 1932.
Where did you marry her? Right there
in Omaha?
Omaha,
yeah.
In Omaha. Omaha. Now, did you have children then?
Gay was born. Gay was our oldest. She was born in 32. I mean, 34. Yeah, 34. And then Penny was born in 43. We lost one child in between. And so we Penny lives in Illinois now. She's married to a United Airlines captain. And she has two boys. And Gay, I lost Gay a year ago, my youngest daughter. And she had lived here in Geauga County, in Jefferson. And all my grandkids, except the ones out in Illinois, live here in Geauga County. And my grandkids, two granddaughters and one grandson, live here in Geauga County.
Well, that's good then. You've got family right around. Now, how did the rigors of baseball life fit with your family? Were there ever any problems because you were, you know, traveling a lot?
Well, I don't, they put up with it really good. And my wife, Sandy, she was a, oh, she was great at it. She was the type of person that, she really took good care of the kids and the home. We had a home here in Cleveland after 35. We finally decided to stay in Cleveland here. But she took care of the home and the kids, and she knew that she'd have to put up with me going on the road all the time. She made friends right away, and the neighbors really took good care of her all the time when I was on the road. So it worked out pretty good.
That's great. Tell me about the stadiums. Which park did you like best, League Park or Municipal Stadium?
Well, I enjoyed pitching at both, the League Park and the Cleveland Stadium. League Park was a tough ballpark to pitch in because of the short right field. But left field was really tough to hit any long balls in because it was 375 feet down the left field line, foul line. And you don't see that anywhere in any stadium anymore. And center field was 460 feet. Left center was 415 feet, and then we had that 40-foot wall on right field, and it was 290 down right field line, and in order to hit a home run, you had to hit high to go over the wall, and you had to hit it hard to go over. So home runs, they were hit pretty good, but there was a lot of balls that hit the fence. The concrete wall was 20 feet. Concrete was 20 feet up, and then the screen was the second 20 feet, so it was 40 feet high. And the balls that hit the concrete would come right straight back into the infield, and sometimes if it hit one of the pillars back in there, concrete pillars, one would go to the right or maybe to the left. And then if it hit above the 20-foot line, the ball would drop straight down to the outfielder. So he had to judge where the ball was going to hit, whether it was going to hit the net or the concrete.
I wouldn't have wanted to be the right fielder.
It was quite a job, yeah. I liked them both. I enjoyed pitching in League Park, and I liked to pitch in the stadium because it was a pitcher's ballpark. When I first went down there, they didn't have that artificial fence out there in the outfield until Bill Veeck bought the ball club. So it was a pitcher's ballpark.
Were there any other stadiums around the league that you liked or disliked?
Well, I had good luck in Kenmore, up in Boston. I won 44 games against the Red Sox, so I had my good luck against the Red Sox. And I had good luck against the Yankees. I beat the Yankees 26 times. And I always had good games in Yankee Stadium. So I enjoyed pitching in Yankee Stadium. Comiskey Park was a good ballpark to pitch in too. They had a third foul line was 352 feet down left field and right field, 352. So that was a good pitcher's ballpark.
Was Griffith Stadium in Washington also a good pitcher's park?
That was another good pitcher's park, yeah.
In my research, I didn't find too many people hitting home runs in Griffith Park.
You didn't hit any cheap home runs in Griffith Stadium. Nope, a really good ballpark.
Now, you pitched the first game at Municipal.
Right.
And you got beat by Lefty Grove 1-0. What was the break in that ball game that threw it Lefty's way?
Well, I went 8 innings, and we got up into the 8th inning, and I walked Max Bishop. I got him down to 3-2, and I threw a ball that I thought was a strike. But the umpires, Max Bishop was a hitter that always was able to get a lot of base on balls, and I think sometimes the umpire would kind of favor a close pitch for Max. But I thought it was a strike anyway. I walked him on a 3-2 pitch, and then Mule Haas, the center fielder for Philadelphia. He sacrificed him to second base, and then Mickey Cochran hit a ball back to left side on the mound, and I just missed getting it with my glove about 6 inches, and it got by me, and it got by Bill Sissel, who was our second baseman. He just missed it going to second base. He just missed it that way. The ball went straight into center field, not too far out, and Earl Averill fielded it and threw it back in. And then Mickey Cochran, scored Bishop from second base on that base hit. Yeah. That was the only run scored.
That was it.
Yeah.
You pitched in four consecutive All-Star games, 1934, 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
And you still hold the major league record for most scoreless innings.
That's right.
Pitchers who pitched 10 or more innings in the All-Star games. What special memories do you have of those four games? What sticks out in your mind as you look back at that experience?
Well, I remember the 34 game more than any of them. That's the day that Carl Hubbell struck out Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe Cronin, Al Simmons, and Jimmy Fox. Consecutively, and that's what everybody remembers about the 34 All-Star game is what Hubbell did. Nobody remembers what I did. I was called in to pitch in the 5th inning. I relieved Red Ruffing. They got a couple men on base and had already scored a couple runs off of Red, and I went into the 5th inning. And they tried a double steal to try to get one run in, but we tried to get the man going to second base, but we didn't get him. So the runner on third scored, but that wasn't my run. That was Red Ruffing's run. Well, then I went on to get him out, to get the National League out and the rest of that inning. And I pitched 5 full innings. I only allowed 1 hit in 5 innings. And we won the game 9-7. And that's the game I remember most. And I got such a big kick out of that.
Yeah, all the Cleveland fans know the real story in that game.
Yeah. But then the consecutive shutout innings, I have 13. I have 13 shutout innings over the 4 All-Star games. And according to records, I'm the only one that's got 13 innings of shutout innings,
right,
in All-Star play.
Now in 1934, You won 20 games and you had 6 shutouts that year. What was the difference that year? What did everything just sort of come together that year for you as a pitcher, or did you develop more of a changeup, or what was it that made the big difference in 34 and then again in 35 when you won 22?
Well, 1932 is when I first started to pitch regular, and I won 11 games in 1932. No, 1930, I'm wrong there. 1930 is when I won 11 games. Well, then I started getting more experience, and I started pitching a little better baseball, and in 31 I had a pretty good year, and then 32 I had another good year. I started getting better and better, more experience, and in 33 I had a chance to have a really good year, but things kind of went bad for me. I lost some tough games, and then starting in 34 I started getting a few more breaks, and I won 20 games. And I lost some tough games, too. I had a chance to win more than 20, but you can't do anything about that. And then in 35, I won 22, and I started getting, you know, just breaks and everything. But I was really at the peak of my career then, too. And I was pitching good ball, and I lost some tough games, and I had a chance to make better years out of the whole year just by winning some of those tough games. You lose 1-0, 2-1, you know, yeah. Games like that.
Well, the team itself finished sort of in the middle of the pack through all those years. 34 and 35, they were in third place, but surrounding that were a lot of fourth place and fifth place finishes.
Well, we finished third and fourth mostly in the 30s.
Right.
But we had good ball clubs. We had good hitting clubs, and we also played when the Yankees were really a hot ball club, and also Philadelphia A's had a great ball club, and then Washington had a good ball. Detroit had a good ball club. And there was good competition amongst the first four or five clubs.
And so it was always a pennant race.
We had a good club, yeah. We'd always stay in the pennant race up until maybe into July. Then we started to fade. And the Yankees in July and August and September would just murder the second division clubs. That's how they'd step out. And the same way with other clubs too, like Detroit and Washington. The last 3 months of this season, they had just murdered the second division clubs. And it was tough then.
Just take them to task. Huh?
Yeah, but we had good clubs.
Now, you worked for a lot of different managers, both as a player and as a coach. If I run the names by you, could you give me a sentence or two about each one and how you felt about them? How about Roger Peckinpah, your first major league manager?
Well, Roger Peckinpah is my favorite manager. He was my first manager. I was just 18 years old when I joined the Indians in spring training in 28. And he was really nice to me. He treated me like a son. Because 18 years old, and my eyes were the biggest thing about me. And it was just a thrill for me to be with a major league club in spring training. But he treated me like a son, and he was very good to me. So I always remembered that, and he was my favorite. And, of course, Walter Johnson came in, wonderful man, but he just had trouble with a couple of ball players on the Indians, and he seemed to take advantage of it. And then the ball club decided to change managers, and he lost his job. Steve O'Neill was a wonderful man. He was manager for a few years. Wonderful person. And then I played for
There's Oscar Witt in there.
Oscar Witt, we had more trouble with Oscar Witt than anybody.
Now, describe that 40 season when some of the players finally went to management. What were the kind of things that led up to that?
Well, the players got so they couldn't get along with Oscar Witt because he was a kind of a guy that would say one thing to your face and another thing behind your back. And he would get on his good ball player, just like Bob Feller. He used to say things about Bob Feller on the bench, the players would hear. And they didn't like that. And they'd say the same thing about me. But as far as getting along with Oscar Witt, I didn't look at it that way. I was willing to go along the rest of the season and forget about him. But we had a couple fellas on the ball club that insisted that they wanted to go see Mr. Bradley and tell him about what they think about Oscar Witt. Well, Johnny Allen and myself kind of vetoed that and tried to talk the ball club into letting us go see Mr. Bradley at his home so nobody would see the ball club going into Mr. Bradley's office. When anybody would see, when people would see the old ball club going in Mr. Bradley's office, they knew that something's up. But if Johnny Allen and I could have gone out to his home and talked to him, we might have got by a little better.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to do it that way. So they decided to go see Mr. Bradley after we left. I was going to go home from Boston to Cleveland. Well, Hal Trotsky was going to be the speaker when we saw Mr. Bradley. But the very day that we left Boston,
that caused a lot of problems after it got out that the ball club had talked to.
Well, Hal Trotsky's mother died, and he had to go to Iowa for the funeral. So he left from Boston for Iowa, and then we all went back to Cleveland. Well, the ones that agreed to go see Mr. Bradley met down in Mr. Bradley's office about, around 11 o'clock in the morning. And they elected me as a speaker to introduce the problems to Mr. Bradley, because I was the oldest ball player on the ball club as far as service and all that concerned. So I talked to Mr. Bradley and told him why we were there, and then the rest of the fellas got into it too. And he sat there and he just listened to all of us, and I think one of the things that kind of got him was Bob Feller being in that group, because Bob Feller was the big man on the club.
Yeah.
But he didn't say too much about it, but it got in the papers right away. And everybody really got on us.
Well, at the end,
I got blamed for a lot of it, and I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
There was a few players that wanted to do that, seeing Mr. Bradley and all that, but they never really got any blame at all. I got the blame because I spoke up at the meeting because I was the oldest player on the club.
Yeah, you were just elected.
Yeah, just elected, that's all.
Well, at the end of the 40 season, Witt left and Peckinpah came back for a year, and then in came Lou Boudreau. What was it like working with Lou?
Fine. Lou was, the first year that he was with the club, I think he was about 24 years old. And he was a good man to work for. I enjoyed working for him. But he was the sort of type that would try things, you know, gamble with a lot of things. And it took a little while to get used to that, but players liked Lou very much. And he was also a great player, which helped him. You know, he played good every year, and felt like during the 48th year, well, he was great that 48th year.
Now, you became a coach, and then the next manager was Al Lopez.
Lopez is one of my favorite managers. I enjoyed Lou Boudreau and Peckinpah, but Al Lopez is one of the best, I think. He was a fine manager. He could handle players, and he knew baseball, and his record stands for itself, you know. He finished second, I think, most of his career. And then he finally won a pennant out in Chicago. But he was a good manager. He knew baseball, and he could handle men. And everybody liked him, too. He had a lot of respect. That's what I think that helped him a lot, you know, being a manager. Everybody respected him.
Following Al Lopez came Kirby Farrell. He was only there for 1 year.
Well, things didn't go very good for Kirby. Things went bad with the ball club, and they decided to make a change. And Kirby didn't last too long.
No. And followed by Bobby Bragan, who lasted even less.
That was another. Things didn't go very well for Bobby either. But Bobby and I got along pretty good. Bobby was a good manager. He knew baseball, and things just didn't go right for him. And so they decided to make a change with him.
In
a short time.
And then in came Joe Gordon. Now, Joe Gordon was a former teammate that came up in 47, think, to the Indians. How was it working with Joe?
Joe was the same way. Joe was a fine person. You couldn't say a bad word about Joe. Players liked him. But I think that what happened is that